From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made earlier this winter when the New York State Legislature revived a conversation about who should be teaching kids about sex, healthy relationships, boundaries, and when that education should begin. Lawmakers are considering a bill that would mandate schools start teaching sex education in kindergarten. To be fair, that's a bit of a misnomer. There's a model for this kind of education, and it does not involve teaching five-year-olds about intercourse. At the earliest levels, this kind of education tends to focus on understanding boundaries, the right to ask someone to stop touching you, healthy relationships, proper terminology, whom to contact in an emergency. New York is currently one of 21 states that do not require schools to teach sex ed at all, including the topics of birth control or STD prevention. There are plenty of opponents of this plan to expand the teaching of sex education into schools. The New York State Catholic Conference, as City Newspaper noted, opposes this legislation, for instance, because the conference says it ignores religious sensibilities and it shuns parents who want the role in guiding their children's sex education. Many Republican lawmakers, too, have railed against the bill. And recently, Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren spoke out against it publicly, saying that it goes way too far and it takes away the role from the people who should be teaching kids about sexuality, their parents. Well, this weekend, Interfaith Impact of New York State's Rochester chapter is sponsoring a program on sexuality education in New York State. But first, we explore that subject this hour on Connections, and I will welcome our guest now. Reverend Richard Gilbert is president of Interfaith Impact of New York State. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Tell us, by the way, what Interfaith Impact is.
It's a coalition of individuals and congregations from Unitarian Universalist, Reformed Jewish, and Protestant denominations who are working for the common good, as we put it, through progressive religious advocacy in New York State.
Okay. And Deborah McDell Hernandez is here, Senior Director of Public and Community Affairs for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. Deborah, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for the invitation.
There is a panel event on this coming Sunday, the 8th. Richard, tell us briefly who's going to be there and what your goal is in organizing this event.
Okay. Our goal is to educate the public in this legislation that's being proposed this session and to encourage people to support it, but support it from a knowledgeable point of view. And so our guests, our panelists, are going to be Jamie Romeo, who is a former assembly member from the 136th District.
Yep.
Deborah, my colleague across the table. Lori Kramer, who is the education coordinator of the OUT Alliance. And Apsara Hale, who is supervisor of health and education outreach for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York.
All right. So you've got a wide background of folks. And by the way, of course, Assemblywoman Romeo is moved into the county clerk's office, right, but has experience at the state level when it comes to this kind of legislation.
And one more thing.
Yep.
The Abara is going to bring the teen empowerment group with her, the In Control group, which will open our program.
Right.
That is Sunday, March 8th, 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the First Unitarian Church of Rochester on Winton.
South Winton Road, 220 South Winton Road.
Okay. One of our goals this hour is to explore what this legislation does and does not do. I think there is some confusion about it, having read through what is being proposed and then reading the public discourse about that. And I think whenever there's confusion, it's valuable to sit down and try to address that. Now, we did reach out to a number of people who are opposed to this legislation and have spoken publicly, whether at organized community meetings or elsewhere. We reached out to Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren, and City Hall did not respond to our request to have her appear on this program to talk about her opposition to this bill. We also had conversations with other guests. We really did actually think we were going to have a full studio because we wanted to hear from voices who opposed it. We don't have anyone in studio. You will hear in a moment from someone who opposes the legislation. But Deborah, let me start with you. Do you think there is a proper understanding of what this is about and what this is not about?
I do not think there is a proper understanding. I think that people hear the word sex education, and when we talk about teaching this to kindergarten age children, they immediately think that we're going to be talking to kindergarten students about sex and how to put on a condom. That is not the case at all.
Shouldn't you call it something else then?
well, you could call it something else, but this really encompasses more than sex. It encompasses healthy relationships. It encompasses issues of consent, you know, teaching kids about the dangers of bullying. It's emotional literacy, ultimately. So there is a lot that is being covered other than sex, and it's all age appropriate. And I think that's part of the problem. People don't realize that over the course of the kindergarten to 12th grade level, that the material in the curriculum will become a little more sophisticated, but it will be age appropriate.
Let's listen to some of the concern. This is Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren recently speaking to WXXI's James Brown about why she decided to publicly come out against this.
I just think that it's wrong that we should have a situation where parents are given the ability to make choices for their children. The fact that we're talking about legislation to have sex education for kindergartners, and I think that's just pushing it way too far, that we have parents, and government cannot continue to take role away from parent and step in, because then you're overstepping. At this point in time, as a mother of a 9-year-old daughter, I want to be able to have those discussions with my child.
All right, Deborah, the mayor says overstepping, and you're taking that role away where it belongs, and that's with the parents. What do you think?
I think people also need to realize that one of the provisions in the bill is that parents and guardians do have the right to opt out. So I just want to put that out there right now. If a parent does have strong opposition to this, there is a provision in the bill that allows a parent or guardian to opt out of having their child enroll in a sex education.
Be part of those lessons.
Exactly. The other piece I want to point out, the mayor stresses the family and parents. One of the things that is missing from sex education, well, we've already established there is no required sex curriculum in New York State. But one of the things that is missing from the way that people are now presenting it is they're not necessarily honoring the diverse design of families. Many of our families are made of same-sex couples. So in the same vein, you have many students who identify as LGBTQ. So wouldn't it be just to include those families, those designs, in the discussion on comprehensive sex education, healthy relationships, consent, etc.? Because right now, it's as if they're being left out of the picture.
So this is sort of an evolution in understanding of relationships and healthy relationships.
Exactly.
Okay. Were you surprised at the mayor's opposition?
I was surprised. I guess I was surprised in the sense that I was hearing this coming from a city official. And generally, these are not decisions made at the city government level.
But she wrote letters to state lawmakers saying she wants to use her voice to lean on them to say no to this.
Right. And I mean, she has just that right to do that. She can voice her opposition. But I was a bit surprised, given the nature of some of the statistics that we have locally for New York State, Monroe County, and the city. And I see this as a means of empowering our students, giving them the tools that they need to navigate life after high school graduation. Because by keeping this information from them, I don't think we're preparing them for the real world. And you need more than a half a semester of sex education to really know what you're doing as far as healthy relations go, safe and responsible sex, issues of consent.
But before I turn back to Reverend, because I know he wants to jump in here, Deborah, maybe the mayor would say, and I can't speak for her, but she might say, look, everything that you're describing, I can handle as a parent. That's my job. You're taking this away from me. What would you say to that?
I would say many parents can take that on, but let's think about the parent who has 3 or 4 jobs. Let's think about the parent who feels embarrassed to talk about sex and relationships with their children. There are many parents who would prefer that someone else with proper training speak to their child about this rather than they taking on that burden.
I think parents, we can agree. There's a wide range in talent when it comes to talking to kids about hard stuff, and we don't always do a great job. I mean, that's not to disparage parents who love their kids and want good things for them. But that, I think it sounds like you think the mayor's position implies that all parents would do an equally solid job at this.
Exactly. And I don't think that is the case at all. I mean, there are a lot of kids who spend much time on their own at home. Some kids don't even have a parent in their household. Maybe they're being raised by other relatives. I just think we really need to provide students with this knowledge.
Okay. Reverend?
Well, the mayor certainly has a right to her opinion. However, the most important thing in this issue is not the mayor's opinion, but whether sexual education in New York State legislation is a proper policy for us to have. I don't see it as an either-or situation. Parents, of course, are primary sexuality educators from birth on, how they treat one another, their attitudes, how they name the body parts, all those things that parents do. I see the public school program as a supplement to what parents do. And, of course, the religious communities have their own programs, too, but that's a very mixed bag. Some don't do a very good job with that.
Well, Chris writes to us on Twitter and says, how dare the Catholic Church interject and try to lecture anybody about how to teach on issues of consent? Is that a fair criticism, or is that sort of a cheap shot, Reverend?
Well, maybe a little bit of both. I wouldn't put it that way, but certainly there's a lot of education to do in the Roman Catholic faith, as in all faith traditions, about sexuality education.
Yeah,
obviously there's been a big slip up there.
To be fair to Chris, I understand the point. This is an organization that has protected abusers. I'm not saying every Catholic or every Catholic leader has, but organizationally, yes. Institutionally, yes. It has protected abusers. And now you want to weigh in on how to help kids navigate? I get why people like Chris are offended by that. But whenever there is legislation on a state level, Deborah, it should aim, I would think, to fix something that's wrong. So what's the risk in continuing as normal as we've been going here without mandating this kind of education, call it healthy relationships, call it sex ed comprehensively starting at kindergarten? What's the risk in going on as we have with this?
Well, there are several risks. We see that there's a rise in STDs, STIs, sexually transmitted infections. So we can continue to let those rates rise in New York State. We can let teen pregnancy rates increase. We can let children walk around not being able to properly identify their anatomical parts and give them the proper names. We can see college campuses continue to grapple with issues of sexual assault. I think, again, when we send kids off to schools within their state, outside of their state, they need to be aware of consent issues. If we don't want to give people these tools and this instruction, I just think we're setting them up for failure. So if we want to see the rate of sexually transmitted infections rise, pregnancies rise, people being ignorant about emotional literacy, social emotional intelligence, then we can sit back and do nothing.
Well, I'd like you, if you could, listen to a conversation I had this morning with Shannon Joy. She's a mother, a community organizer. She's the host of the Shannon Joy Show on Wham Radio. She has deep concerns about this. And in lieu of being able to have someone in studio who could speak about some of the opposition, and again, we reached out to the mayor, didn't get a response, and there's a number of other organizations and individuals who do oppose this, I wanted to make sure we had that voice here. So Shannon was kind enough to take some time this morning. We recorded this interview. I want to listen to her concerns about this education that would mandate schools, with an opt-out provision, as Deborah mentioned, to start sex education in kindergarten. Call it sex education, probably a misnomer at the kindergarten level, but the bottom line is Shannon Joy opposes that. And here are some of those concerns that I think are representative of some of the opposition. Let's listen.
Hey, thank you so much, Evan. I really appreciate being on with you today.
All right. So I know you've got some thoughts on sex education and a mandate that could come from New York State government for schools to address it starting as early as kindergarten. Where are you on this issue?
Well, I'm always weary of any type of comprehensive education in any way. I'm pretty consistent on this. I was a strong advocate for local control of public education back during the big Common Core discussion and debate. I aligned very closely with the teachers unions, actually, here in Rochester and in the state, and really advocating for local communities, parents, teachers, administrators to have ultimate control control over how their kids are educated. And one of the things I'm very concerned about, in the same way that Common Core was comprehensive education standards and testing standards and data collection, we're seeing the same phenomenon here with comprehensive sexual education. This is not something local to New York State. This is not something unique. It's something that's been rolled out across the nation over the past 4 or 5 years. In fact, on some of the websites, the proponents of comprehensive sexual education will tell you that it's already embedded in 41% of American public schools. And so this is something that is coming out of Washington, D.C., and it's being pushed by unions, to be honest. I mean, one of the organizations, CICUS, it's S-C-I-C-U-S, which the best I can tell, CICUS is a national sex education workers union. Right. And this is from their website. They rebranded. They said the mission is sexual education for social change. And they at CICUS, we believe that sex ed can spark the social change we need in a response to a variety of pressing issues, from sexual violence to reproductive injustice to LGBTQ discrimination and more. That's why we're now CICUS, Sex Ed for Social Change. They've just rebranded. So this is a political thing more than it is about helping young kids or educating young kids in the area of sexuality.
Do you think most people who support this legislation, though, are in that camp?
I don't think they know about it, to be honest. And that's one of the big problems here. FOES, it's the Future of Sex Education. They are the crafters of the comprehensive sexual education curriculum. It's about 44 pages long, and any of your listeners can go onto their website and pull it up, and it will in great detail explain exactly what the different elements are of the comprehensive sexual education. And I doubt that many of the people pushing sex education have read those standards, to be quite honest. One of the things that is very worrisome for me, and I have read the standards, I've been reporting on them for probably 4 or 5 years. One of the things that is most, you know, concerning to me is the omission of the parent halfway through the curriculum as a trusted guidance, right? So in the curriculum in the early years, part of the curriculum says to young children, identify a trusted adult or parent that you can talk to about sexual things. By the time you move into the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade standards, they've omitted the word parent, Evan. You know, find a trusted adult. I don't know what they mean by that, but for parents, I mean, I have 3 small kids. Well, they're not small anymore, Evan. I have a 13-year-old, Jackson, an 11-year-old, and a 7-year-old. And I've taught them from very small, Evan, that they are never to talk to any adult except for me about anything of a sexual nature. Not grandma, not grandpa, not uncles, not coaches. And I do that for them to keep them safe. One of the things I'm worried about is a desensitization of young children about adults talking to them about very, very private things. Hmm. Anatomy, right? And so that's just one of my concerns. There are, I mean, a myriad of concerns.
So let me hit a couple of points there. I'm thinking about the kids who come from families that are not like yours, kids who come from families where there has been abuse, parents are perhaps absent, and sometimes parents are absent for long stretches of time because it might be a single parent household and someone's working 2 or 3 jobs and they're trying to make ends meet. Sometimes it is an abusive situation. I'm thinking about the kids who don't have a situation where you've got parents really sort of hyper attuned to what they're hearing in schools, et cetera, and who, absent a school approach, something comprehensive, are going to hear something from friends, from media, from YouTube, and What do we think about them and the risk that they would have, that they would be at?
Yeah, you know, you certainly want to take those kids into account, but we all have to remember that those kids are a minority. I mean, that is something, even in some of our poorer districts, most parents are still involved. Most parents want to be involved. And so those kids, Evan, are the ones, quite frankly, that are the most vulnerable to sexual predators and to people who could potentially hurt them. And so those are the kids that you really, I mean, you have to be careful with. But But in most school districts, my husband is a school psychologist in one of the larger school districts in Monroe County, and there are you know, things set up to identify kids who might be in abusive home situations that might have. I mean, most teachers and psychologists are mandated reporters. I mean, there are all sorts of systems put into place to protect those kids at the periphery. I don't think the answer is to have a one-size-fits-all blanketed comprehensive sexual education system that really, to be honest, it makes a lot of people rich. I mean, the corporations that are writing the curriculums and changing the curriculums and recommending all of the different activities and literature, I mean, it's a huge business. And so I just am uncomfortable with using our kids. I think that most school districts have superintendents and principals and administrators who are highly educated, who can come up with and work on a comprehensive sexual education curriculum in their own school, right? If that's something that the parents want, if that's something that the parents believe they need in a certain school district, then I would have no problem with that happening. It is this massive, massive one-size-fits-all, which enriches a few and puts, you know, a few in charge of everything, but really can, I think, be harmful to not only individual kids, but with this very critical idea that local institutions should be locally controlled and not controlled from the outside in.
All right, and last point on this. I do think that they have, at the very least, sort of a branding issue. Calling it sex ed in kindergarten has a connotation that rings a little shocking to some people who hear that term. And for the most part, as I understand it, they're not talking about intercourse with kindergartners. They're talking about healthy boundaries. They're talking about what happens if someone is touching you and in a way that you don't want them to touch you, even kids poking each other on the playground and teaching them that you are allowed to say no from an early age. Those are themes that I think do form a foundation in the long run, according to experts who have certainly more experience in the field than I do. Those are themes that form a foundation that says in the future, you're going to have a better basis for understanding bodily autonomy, the rights of others, rights of others to say no. So if they call this healthy relationships and not sex ed in kindergarten, does that change anything?
I would still oppose anything comprehensive and imposed from the top down. Evan, I will tell you, every kindergarten teacher I have had kids who have gone through the school system. Every school district has their own kind of curriculum that talks about personal space, that talks about kindness and boundaries and you know, the way that you should relate to one another. And so I think this is something that we already have in place in our schools. And really, again, forcing a comprehensive curriculum into every single school is not about the kids. It's about a one-size-fits-all program that is really a big business, right? Because once you put this in place, then all of the schools have to buy all of the approved curriculum materials, and they have to employ new employees in order to roll this out. And it really is just another expansion, I think, of the state into our local school districts. But, you know, to answer your point, I think that if that's important, and I think it is, I mean, it's something that we could certainly address here in Monroe County. We could certainly address in individual school districts. It doesn't have to be this one-size-fits-all, top-down approach.
Our thanks to Shannon Joy for that conversation. And Deborah, Deborah McDell-Hernandez is here, Senior Director of Public and Community Affairs for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. Let me start with you. There's a lot there.
Yes.
Where do you want to start?
Well, I'd like to briefly read what the mission of the two organizations is that she politicized and sensationalized, and they are the basis for the curriculum that is proposed for K through 12. So, Future of Sex Education Initiative, FOES, was launched in 2007 as a partnership between Advocates for Youth, ANSWER, and the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the U.S., SECIS. The goal of National Sexuality Education Standard is to provide clear, consistent, and straightforward guidance on the essential minimum core content for sexuality education that is developmentally and age appropriate for students in grades K through 12. So that seems rather straightforward to me. It doesn't seem like there's anything suspect in that.
Well, she might argue that it is subjective what is developmentally appropriate, and this is an organization that has is trying to inject into the conversation or into the classroom things that she does not think are appropriate. So you want to kind of go over some of the standards, the ideas. Again, if you're just joining us, if this legislation passes, New York State would for the first time have mandatory sex education K through 12. Now, at the K level, that's what people are kind of getting tripped up on. It's not, as Reverend Gilbert said, it's not teaching how to put on a condom in kindergarten. I mean, it's quite different than that. And Deborah is going to read a little bit about what it would be at the kindergarten level.
Yeah, so let's take a look at K through third grade.
Okay.
Identify different family structures, friendships, and healthy ways to express feelings. Explain that all people have the right to not be touched. Identify trusted adults and demonstrate how to clearly say no. Explain why bullying and teasing are wrong and how to respond. Describe healthy relationships and demonstrate positive communication. Understand that all living things reproduce. Use proper names for body parts, including male and female anatomy.
That last one's interesting. Do you have a problem with sort of the infantilization of body parts, the way kids sometimes refer to certain body parts, Deborah?
Well, I'm not going to criticize families that give different names to body parts, but I do think it is important for young people to understand the proper names of their anatomy. So when things happen, if something suspect happens, they're aware of what these body parts, how they're actually called and why it may have been inappropriate for someone to touch them in that body part. So there's less room for misinterpretation if a child's trying to explain what someone did.
Patrick writes to say, Evan, who is supposed to educate children on sex ed when the parents don't? I grew up never having any discussions on sex or healthy communication with my parents. And now as an adult in my 30s, I struggle significantly with those aspects of my relationships in my life. That is a very straightforward email from Patrick, and I applaud your willingness to share that, Patrick. Thank you. So let's hit that. And I'm going to get both of our guests in studio to respond on the question of parents. But let me get Rich in Rochester on the phone, because what you just heard from Shannon is her belief that most parents are fine with this stuff. They're good at it. They care. They want to talk to their kids. My concern, as I expressed to her in the interview, are kids who don't have parents like her, who are really going to work carefully and diligently and appropriately. And unfortunately, I think that's a lot more kids than she's sort of taking into account here. She disagrees. This is Rich on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Hello. How you doing, Evan?
Good.
I see a lot of problems with what your guest who's against this is saying. Number one, I think, to your point, you sort of pointed at it. It bothered me how she minimized the children who did not have the parents. Also, I feel she's coming from a very privileged position talking about what she knows and what she doesn't know. Also, I think there's the estimate of people who do a good job of sex education with kids. I think it's pretty hard, and it's evident in the society that we live in and the things that happen in our society. Also, I just had so much wrong with what she said. As soon as she attacked the group Sika as being political. My question is, when a group advocates a position, if it's two or three, isn't any group of political, and is political this horrible thing just because you have a position that you think is healthy and you think that's helpful? Also, her attack on the money aspect, that to me, that's a red herring so many times, because everybody always talks about someone who's going to make money. I haven't seen anybody from either side of any issue who didn't figure out a way to make money. So I don't have a problem with this. But my bottom line is this, and this is going to be controversial. If parents were so great at the jobs that they do, why do we have so many issues out here with sexual disease, with rape, with all the things that go on? If our parents are so great, and I'm a parent, and if we're all so good here, and if we all have this innate ability to know what's good for our children, then why don't we do it? These are these statements that people make fall apart in the face.
And we lost. lost you there, Rich, but I think we've got the, I think generally the comment, and I appreciate that, Rich. Thank you. Look, first of all, I want to say again, I appreciate Shannon coming on the program, and I think she wants what's best for her kids and all kids. I don't think there's any question. I do agree with Rich that I think we got to be very careful in assessing how many parents want to take this on and are good at taking this on. And let me ask both of our guests. So, Deborah, best guess, what percentage of parents do you think are doing a good job, appropriate job, at all levels, talking to their kids about healthy relationships, interaction, bodily autonomy, and sex?
I'm going to say probably less than 50%. That's just my wild card guess.
I was like a quarter, maybe.
But less than 50, maybe I'm being too generous. I think even...
Not most.
I think you're being too generous.
Maybe, not
let's,
most.
Let's say 30%.
Not most.
Perhaps. But I think the... Okay, let's say they're talking to their kids about sex. But are they talking to their kids about sex using medically accurate, evidence-based scientific terms? I think a lot of parents maybe have to do some catching up or refreshing on sexuality. They weren't taught it, depending on how old or young the parent may be and which school district they were enrolled in. They may or may not have been given good lessons. So if they didn't learn it well during their school days and their parents didn't teach it to them, I'm not certain how much confidence we can put in some parents to deliver the correct information.
We do, Reverend, have a society where the rates of sexual harassment, sexual assault are at minimum, I think everyone would probably agree, way higher than they should be and what should be deemed acceptable. Do you trace some of that to poor education?
Yes. In fact, I was going to say that when Shannon Joy accuses Seekers of political activities and so forth, in a way, she's right, because Me Too is a political movement all about consent and permission and relationships. And this is aimed directly at helping children make those proper decisions. LGBTQ plus is a legal and moral issue. Very few parents are comfortable talking about that. Reproductive justice is also a very sensitive issue. What I'm seeing or saying about Shannon Joy is, if you read the legislation, you realize that the Department of Education will develop standards, principles for this program. They will develop a model course, and then they will work with the local school districts, which will have the power to develop their own curriculum, providing it meets the principles of the state course. So it's not as if one sex education program is imposed on every district in exactly the same way. It could be very different. And as for isolating the child, if we don't trust our teachers to teach our children, if we don't trust anybody else but ourselves, that's a very small community. I always thought it takes a whole community to raise a child. Parents are a vital part, the most important part of that community probably, but not the only part. We need to trust our teachers. We need to trust our friends. We need to be able to trust our religious leaders in all of this. And so I will give one example. My own denomination, Unitarian Universalist Association, along with the United Church of Christ, has developed a program called OWL, Our Whole Lives, which stresses sexual education at the very youngest ages, all the way through the latest development, which is a sexuality unit for older people, like me, at 83. It's an ongoing process. The kids who go through this OWL program, we have found, when they get to high school, in college, they become the sexuality educators among their peers because they have information, they discuss the issues, they have developed their values, and the other kids are just swimming around in a sea of ignorance. And ignorance in this case is not bliss.
I mean, I recently heard a 7-year-old ask, is sex a bad word? It's not a bad word, but when no one is teaching you even the basics of what it might be, you're going to learn from your friends at school, you're going to learn on the bus, you're going to learn through YouTube and and all of the media that didn't exist necessarily when we were growing up. That's where kids will get this from. There's no question about that.
It's what I call spiritual osmosis. We just ingest all of this, all of our experiences that we have. It's not as if we can turn the switch on and say, this is a learning experience, this isn't. Everything is has the potential of being a learning experience.
Okay. I have to get our only break of the hour, but I want to come back, and I've got sort of split in audience reaction on some of this, and we're going to take more of your phone calls. If you want to be a part of the conversation that the community is going to be having on Sunday, it is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Sexuality education in New York State. How much should be taught? It's at Sunday, March 8th. That's this Sunday, 2 o'clock at the First Unitarian Church of Rochester on South Winton Road, Interfaith Impact of New York State. Rochester chapter is sponsoring this program, and a lot of people will be there. Reverend Gilbert is here from Interfaith Impact. Deborah McDell-Hernandez is the Senior Director of Public and Community Affairs for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. Let's get your feedback after our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections. Thinking about getting an electric car? Sales in the last 4 months have slowed with EVs in the United States, and it corresponds pretty snugly with the rolling back of some of the available rebates. So what would it take to drive demand again for the electric vehicle market? Are you thinking about EVs? Where's the best place to start? We'll try to help you Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Jim in Irondequoit next. Go ahead, Jim.
Howdy.
Hi, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I think this is just further encroachment on the rights of parents, and maybe it's time we start conducting education in an a la carte form where I get to pick and choose what my kids take and not take, because where does this end? How far away do we get from natural law where my child's education is my responsibility first, and I should have the option to be able to go, no, I don't want my kid learning that. He'll learn it from me. She'll learn it from me. Thank you anyway.
So, Jim, a couple of things on that. First of all, I want to make sure I have it right, Deborah. You're saying that this proposed legislation at the state level does allow parents to opt out of their kids being in these lessons. Is
correct.
That correct?
That's correct.
That's
okay.
Correct.
Didn't know that.
All right, so you could opt out if you decide, look, I don't want schools teaching my kids this. I got it. You opt out, and the idea, I assume, is they'll send you a different room for a different lesson that day. But, Jim, I also want to make sure I understand more. What's your biggest concern here with this legislation? I mean, when you hear that schools might be teaching about healthy relationships, what's the concern that you have?
Just the simple fact that I don't want something that I should be responsible teaching my child handed over to a state authority. Mm-hmm. It's an encroachment I don't think is natural or necessary. And it should be up to parents to decide what they want. Now, as far as being able to opt out, I wasn't aware of that. I'm glad that exists. Somehow I get the feeling that will fall away as this carries on.
Okay. So number one, Jim is advising if this goes forward at all, don't scrap the opt-out provision. He wants that kept. But Jim, what about kids who don't have parents like you? What about kids who are from abusive families or neglectful families, or frankly, just households where the parents aren't interested or aren't really equipped to have these conversations? Is it appropriate for them to get it from school as opposed to wherever else in society they might get it?
It's up to their parents, isn't it?
Well, yes, I'm saying that the parents may not be addressing it at all.
Well, it's not that I'm against.
You still there, Jim? Oh, we lost Jim. I'm sorry about that. Jim, if we lost you, I didn't cut the call. Okay. As always, Jim, I appreciate the phone call. Go ahead, Reverend.
I was going to ask Jim if he felt completely competent to do all the sexuality education of his children
with nobody else
involved.
He may say yes.
He's a marvelous parent if mm-hmm. he can do all of that. That's quite amazing.
Well, I mean, I think there are parents, I mean, people like Shannon, who I talked to earlier this hour, who do feel that they would be in that category. You sound skeptical.
I've known a lot of parents in my day, and these are most of the parents I've known have been highly educated, sophisticated parents, and they are eager to have the help that the church and the schools can provide.
What would you say to Jim, Deborah?
Well, I like that you pose that question to him, because I think people are forgetting about the marginalized segments of society, those children who are in abusive households, those kids who might be fending for themselves, or, you know, parents are dealing with other issues and they just don't have that as a source of knowledge at home and support. So what about those kids? Do we just leave them to figure it out on their own?
Also, think of all the people who are coming forward under the new New York State Child Victims Act. Hundreds, thousands of people, they did not know what was appropriate and what was not appropriate. They were not able to bring to the attention of other people the abuse that they were suffering. And that's a very sad story.
Indeed.
All right, Deb in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Deb.
Hi there. I'm an OBGYN in town, and one of my, specialties is working with adolescents. I've been in practice for about 30 years, so I spent a lot of time, in my office seeing parents with their children. And I would just like to comment that there's been a few comments on what we've heard so far. One is that there's a lot of talk about the marginalized children that should be talked, and maybe, maybe a lot of the other children in more privileged situations already have their parents talk to them. I would just say, because I've worked with all different types of folks from every walk of life, and I would just say universally with all the kids, I hear so much from parents really uncomfortable talking to their children, asking me for recommendations on resources, how to talk to the kids. And then when I see the children themselves, I don't think the background necessarily, informs how much that student's going to know. You know, I have very educated parents whose kids really don't know much. Mm-hmm. And, so I think this is important for all children. Interestingly, you know, the comment about CECAS, the organization, is prior to their current role. I have recommended that website a lot in the organization, because they used to be, their focus was on teaching parents how to talk to their kids. So it's just kind of interesting commentary. Regarding the comprehensive approach and a top-down, I can really understand that, because you don't want to dictate and micromanage everything, but I think having some minimum standards is a really good idea. I just think back at my experience as a parent, and when my children went through a suburban school, I was looking at the curriculum, I asked them what they were learning, and some of it was very dated and not correct. Hmm. And so I think it's really important, you know, that we have this and we have minimum standards. Our neighbors up north, Canada, has very comprehensive information about sexual education. And, you know, a lot of our teachers here are using that information.
Okay, but Deb, briefly, before I let you go, what do you think animates the opposition then? When you hear the mayor saying, this is way too far, I got this, when you hear others saying they're not comfortable with it, what do you think animates that?
I think one of the biggest things is the idea that if children learn about this, it's going to give a green light and be like, it's okay. And worried about increased participation in sexual, you know, experiences, maybe being sexually active at a younger age. And I really think that's, you know, I think that's what underlies it. There can also be, just the feeling of the parents for children to, you know, wait to become involved with sexual activity until they're married, mm-hmm. perhaps, and the concern about, this is telling us it's okay, and I do understand that.
Mm-hmm. Deb, thank you for the phone call. Another data point from an OBGYN. This is Susan in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi. Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay. So I wanted to say that I'm one of the few people whose mother took them aside and gave them the sex talk. And I was 10 years old at the time, and I thought, ugh, why would you ever want to do that? But at age 14, I had my first sexual experience, and it was not consensual. And when I was in high school, I became pregnant. So while my mother was good at covering the mechanics of sex, she really didn't cover the relationship part. And I feel like that's so important. But by the same token, I don't fault her for, you know, not covering it. I'm grateful that she did do the talk, but I think that when she was growing up, when she was my age, the sexual landscape was very, very different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she probably had no idea what was going on in my junior high or high school.
Susan, this is a pretty remarkably powerful phone call. And number one, I just want to thank you for being willing to share your experience. And I certainly take the point. I don't take your call as sort of condemning your mother in any way. But it is observing the limitations that parents may have, even when they are trying their best. And so let me ask you, if you're willing to kind of express it, you seem to connect your mother's attempt to talk to you at 10 and beyond in a mechanical way versus the dynamics of the relationships that ended up happening, including a non-consensual, you called it a sexual experience, it sounds like an assault. Do you think that could have been avoided or different if your education had been different?
Absolutely. You know, it was sort of, well, when you're, you know, that age going through puberty, it all seems very interesting and fun, and it's hard to know when to put brakes on. And in my case, I think that I couldn't really find the brakes. So that kind of information, it's the relationship part and the, you know, when are you ready part were covered for me. It would have made a huge difference. And the other thing that I would like to say too is that if I had told my mother that I had had sex at age 14, she probably would have shipped me off to a convent. I mean, that's not a discussion that I would have been able to have with my mother.
Hmm. So one other aspect I want to just briefly talk to you about, Susan, then I'll turn it over to our guests in studio, is you're reflecting on what you might have done differently or how you might have understood the dynamics. I'm also thinking, having been a boy in high school who didn't get a lot of education about this, you've got to learn on your own, if you don't get it from something, to understand boundaries, respect for others, consent, what consent really is. And I know mm-hmm. this is an overgeneralization because consent issues go across the spectrum of gender, sexuality, et cetera. But there is sort of this old dynamic in, often in high school settings, where the boys are out to get some. And if they are taught the mechanics of sex, as you put it, but not that it is not appropriate to pressure someone into giving something that they're not expressing a want to give you, that's I think that's a problem too. And I don't know who the person was in that scenario with you at 14, but I doubt that that person was getting education on anything beyond the mechanics in terms of how to respect boundaries, what consent is, what's appropriate. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. Yeah, I don't think that, the dynamic that you described is absolutely the way that it was. It was sort of like the boy is getting something, scoring, and the girl is giving something up. Mm-hmm. And that's inappropriate. That's not a relationship that anyone wants to have.
Thank you for sharing this story. I find it really powerful. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And so that, to me, Deborah, does not say, again, that what's being offered in kindergarten, first grade, second grade would have covered sexual consent in terms of what she dealt with. But it forms the basis, I think, from what I'm understanding, of understanding respecting boundaries, respecting what a no is, in a lot of different scenarios. It's kind of a foundation of building a house, I would think.
Right. And it goes, I keep using that word, emotional literacy, but, you know, that was clearly absent in this experience that Susan shared with us. As she said, she learned the mechanics, and perhaps the other person was familiar with the mechanical aspects of sex as well. But I wanted to come back to one of the points that was made by, what was her name?
Deb.
Shannon.
Shannon, yeah.
Regarding superintendents making their own decisions specific to their districts. And I just wanted to share briefly a Niagara Falls City School District success story, because their superintendent, Mark Lowry, was alarmed that Niagara Falls had the highest rate of STIs and teen pregnancy and knew something needed to be done. They even had a forum where students were asking for help, because students also were alarmed with this. So in December 2017, by a vote of 8-1, the board approved them implementing a more comprehensive sex education plan in the school. And recently, some figures were released from a youth risk behavior survey that the CDC did with the Niagara Falls region. And there have been some really favorable statistics. Physical dating violence decreased from 13% in 2015 to 10.4% in 2019. Students reporting having sexual intercourse decreased from 42.6% to 37.6%. Students with more than four sexual partners decreased from 14.3% to 8.8%. And the list goes on. There's plenty of data here. But
more knowledge, less activity.
Yes.
Interesting.
So, but that was a case. This superintendent took on the school. The parents were opposed in the beginning. Other administrators were. But he saw this as something needing intervention.
We're going to continue to talk about this. I know it's sensitive, and I just want to say again to parents, whether it's people like Shannon or others, I mean, if you oppose this, we respect that, and we want to keep talking. I'm not an advocate. I'm a parent, but I do understand some of the goal. But I also want to understand where everyone is on this issue, and we'll keep having those conversations here. Deborah, thank you. Thanks for being here and sharing your expertise this
thank
hour.
You.
And Reverend Gilbert, the president of Interfaith Impact of New York State, is helping host this event that's coming your way on Sunday, 2 to 4:30 at the First Unitarian Church of Rochester. Good luck with that. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Raymond. Thanks very much.
To our whole team here, MRA Stein interning, Rob Braden engineering, Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Oh, Tim Shea, of course, volunteering. We'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.